Okay, then continuing text 149. That the mentions here that anyone teaches him in the Veda, whether it's a little or a lot, then he is to be seen as guru. Now that should be, they should be respected as guru. So that's a, so anyone who can give one direction or instruction in the Veda, whatever it is, either in the Veda itself, means the Shastra itself, or the application of the Veda, helping us apply it in our life, then, or teaching us the actual philosophical meanings behind it, whatever way, then we see that person as guru. So this is a important aspect. Siksha guru means that we respect those who we gain knowledge from, to whatever degree, means to that degree, you know, however much it is, to that degree is also that respect. And it also depends not necessarily by volume, but by the quality or the depth also. Someone may give just a little philosophical direction, and that is much deeper than someone who may, you know, teach us so many shlokas, or show us how to do a particular aspect of, you know, deity worship or something like that. It also must be seen in relation to that, how deeply or how much it affects our life and how much it helps us advance. So also that aspect will be who is seen as more, how you say, respectable and more respectable amongst those who guide us, like that. So this is different, this is going on from, the point is being made is that it shows those who teach the scriptures along with their application, along with their hidden meanings, the philosophy, like that is the teacher, that is the main person who is guiding us. Then someone who teaches a portion, one aspect, they're also respected, but they only teach a part. They're not as respectable, let's say, one who can teach the whole thing. Then you have here, then it's saying that someone who teaches anything, if it's in connection with the scriptures, if it's connection with the actual philosophy or application of Krishna consciousness in their life, they're to be seen as respected as teacher, as guru. So this is the siksha guru here. Then it's also making the point that the, how you say? Yeah, and then that person who trains him or, you know, completely absorbs him in understanding the scriptures and that person is to be considered as the mother and father. And then it's mentioning that on the material platform, then the how do you say? Yeah. So if someone is just giving the material knowledge, then the acharya is 10 times more venerable than the one who only means who can teach the whole Veda to one who teaches a part of the Veda. More than that is the mother. Then more than that is the father. But this is all, then it mentions that then one who gives the natural birth, the mother and father, they're not as respectable as one who gives the actual birth and knowledge. And then Prabhupada pointed out that then there's the more deep than that, one who initiates one into spiritual knowledge. That's even deeper than that. So the point's being made here then because of the activity of its lasting effect. It means the spiritual knowledge is eternal. Then the material, the Vedic knowledge and all this is useful throughout the whole life. And then the mother and father, they've given us the birth and they have given us the preliminary trainings. And then here it finishes that one who teaches us in anything, then they are to be respected. Okay, so then the next point is given here. That Brahmana who is the giver of the birth for the sake of the Veda, in other words, one who initiates one into Veda, or one who trains one in the Veda, and the teacher of the prescribed duties, becomes by law the father of an aged man, even though he himself be a child. Example here is given of young Kavi, the son of Angiras, taught his relatives who were old enough to be fathers, and as he excelled them in sacred knowledge, he called them little sons. They, moved with resentment, asked the gods concerning that matter, and the gods, having assembled, answered, "The child has addressed you properly. For a man destitute of sacred knowledge is indeed a child, and he who teaches him the Veda is his father, for the sages have always said child to an ignorant man and father to a teacher of the Veda. Neither through years, nor through white hairs, nor through wealth, nor through powerful kinsmen comes greatness. The sages have made this law. He who has learnt the Veda together with the Angas is considered great by us. The seniority of Brahmanas is from sacred knowledge, that of Kshatriyas from valor, that of Vaishyas from wealth and grain and other goods, and that of Shudras alone from age. A man is therefore not considered venerable because his head is gray. Him who, though young, has learned the Veda, the gods consider to be venerable." Okay, so it's pointing out is A, see, we've discussed this whole thing of age before. This is what makes the Vedas not always so easily understandable, is these descriptions. Because it's going through, we have to understand is the material duties, they contact the spiritual duties. Because the process, what is happening is, if we want to enter the spiritual realm, then we have to be of the quality of the spiritual realm. Just like the fish has the nature of water, it can live in water. You know? Or the sun god has the nature of fire, he lives in fire. And those residents of the sun planet, they also have that nature, they can live in fire. So if we want to live in the spiritual realm, we have to be accustomed to following that spiritual culture. So that culture then being given to us, then is for the purpose of elevating oneself or qualifying oneself to enter the spiritual realm and follow the culture there. But we find that many people aren't interested in going back to Godhead. You know, if you take a census of the 5 billion people on the planet, then you'll probably find not many of them are that interested in going back to Godhead. Even those who know the Veda are not necessarily, they're heavenly planets, or, you know, they're interested in Lord Shiva, or, you know, something. You know, just want to become wealthy, happy, powerful, something. But from the Vedic knowledge, from the Vedic process. So they're willing to follow the Vedic culture, but not for the purpose of going back to Godhead. So therefore you'll see that the distinction between the two is made. But in culture, there's certain basic things, they apply in both spheres. In the material platform, you respect seniors. On the spiritual platform, you respect seniors. Though there's a difference in the two, right? So many times we'll see, they'll go through and describe the material situation. You know, you have to be nice, you have to be properly behaved, this, that, and this person is respectable like this, this one like that. And then it makes a distinction between those who give the material birth, those who give the birth of knowledge. Like this. So then it gives two, they're overlapping, they're like parallel. You know, you can put one on the other. But one is on the purely material platform, then one is on the higher aspects or lower material platform, on fruitive activities, one is on the higher activities of jnana. But then on top of that you can put the original, which is the spiritual activities themselves, which the other two have reflected from. So depending upon what is the point being made, then the shastra may be talking about any one of these three levels. The level of karma, the level of jnana, or the level of the spiritual. But the activity will be the same. Respect for seniors will be there on all three levels. So sometimes you'll see that it'll be described in one level, and then they'll say, but this person is more respectable than that. After they've just said, you know, your mother and father are, you know, they're, you know, they are as, you know, good as represent the Supreme Lord, right? Is it? Matri Devo Bhava, Pitri Devo Bhava, Atiti Devo Bhava, that the guest, the father, the mother, they're respected like you would respect God. But then it also goes on to say, Acharya Devo Bhava, that the one who teaches one in this knowledge, he is also respected. And then of this, Prabhupada points out that then the one who gives the spiritual knowledge, just not the Vedic material knowledge, but the spiritual knowledge, then is higher than that. So we see all the three levels are there. All these different levels. So if we really want to understand the Dharma Shastra, Vaishnava etiquette, and just how sadhana bhakti works and all that, and the relationship between the Vedic Pancharatrik and the Bhagavat, we have to understand that these three levels, they superimpose on each other. But the Bhagavat is the origin. Then from that, Bhagavat is made into rules and regulations as Pancharatra and the Vedic. So the Vedic can be followed by anyone who has the, you know, the intelligence, the piety to follow. The Pancharatrika is followed by those who are interested in worshipping the Lord, but they may still maintain material desire, or they may not, or they're interested to go to Vaikuntha. And then the Bhagavad is for those who are specifically, definitely interested to qualify themselves to go back to Godhead, and specifically for us, those who want to go to Golok Vrindavan. So all these three aspects have to be able to be accommodated at one time and see what their relationship is. Then these seemingly contradictory points, where it just mentions one whole point and then it writes that whole point off for another higher level. But it's going through the same thing. Just like you have the mother and then you have the father. Right? So in the same way as you have someone who teaches just part of the Veda and someone who teaches the whole Veda. Right? Then you have anyone who teaches you anything actually in spiritual life and then one who takes commitment to take you back to Godhead. Right? Then you have the founder acharya, the previous acharyas, like this, all in the spiritual platform. So you have the same principle is there. Right? You have the parents who gave you birth into the material world, the material body. You have the teacher who gives one birth into knowledge. And you have the spiritual personalities, spiritual leaders who give one birth into the spiritual culture. So there's three aspects of birth. So in each one of them, there's someone who's more or less respectable. But each level is more respected than the last. So even though it says the acharya here, one who teaches in the Veda, and it's how to apply it, the kalpa, the rituals, then what are the hidden portions of that, what are the purposes, and what is the philosophy of the Upanishads, he's the most respected of all the teachers. Like that. But then, we know that higher than that is someone who can teach one in spiritual subject matter. The actual spiritual, the bona fide sampradayic, like this. So you get these things. But the principle remains, is that within a strata, there's more and less respectable. And each strata has that. And the higher strata, the lowest one on the higher strata, is higher than the highest one on the next one down. Right? So let's say on the material you have the father. But then higher than that on the platform of the Vedic culture and all that, the knowledge, then you'll have the, you know, someone who teaches anything. You know? Higher than that is someone who can teach actually a serious portion of the Vedas. Higher than that, someone can teach the whole Veda. And it's knowledge of a vocation.
So that's the highest there. But then that person is less than the lowest on the transcendental platform. Like that. So that is there. At the same time, we still apply the general Vedic rules of just like someone by age is more respectable, or someone by knowledge. You know, the person who knows, let's say, all the Veda, though he's not a devotee. And a devotee who is, let's say, a nice preacher, but he doesn't know all the Vedas. Means he does by knowing Bhagavatam and that, but he doesn't know all the shlokas and all the rituals and all that. So technically, that devotee who can give you that spiritual knowledge is higher than the other. Like that. So someone who's looking for the spiritual will know that this person, if the devotee says this is important, you know, and the other person who's the great pundit in the Veda says no, it's something else, you take the devotee. Because he's working on the higher strata. Even though he may be the lower end of the higher strata, he's still higher than the next level down. But when it comes to like giving a seat or this or that, you know, publicly and dealings and just the interface, the person who has the knowledge and he's more older and all these different things, that will be respected. In other words, the person will be respected for his age and for his knowledge. He cannot be disrespected. At the same time, you may give more surrender to that devotee who's the preacher. Though, depending upon the situation, that may be shown more or less, depending upon how much you either you're in a position to make a point or not. Just like Advaitacharya, when he was doing his ceremony at his house, and it was time for the ceremony of the Bhojapatra. With Bhojapatra is that after worshipping the Lord and all that, then there is the offering that is left on that plate that is given to the most qualified Brahmin that is there, who is the most, you know, learned, knowledgeable, you know, just senior most. So Advaitacharya, then so many Brahmins with it, because Advaitacharya is, you know, he's big. He's like the leader of all the Brahmins. So he's having a program, so all the Brahmins are there, and each one is thinking, I'm going to be the one, because I know this better, or that one, know that better, you know. Each one is expert, you know, more expert than the other in another aspect of Vedic knowledge. You know, and then there's age, and then there's experience, and each one is thinking, I'm the one. And then at the end of it, when he actually gave the Bhojapatra, he gave it to Haridas Thakur. Because he's chanting the holy name. He's a devotee. So he has realized the conclusion of the whole Brahminical understanding and culture. So he's a devotee. And not only that, he's the Namacharya. So he's the most. Though materially and all that, you'll see when Haridas Thakur acts and all that, and nobody complains. He'll ask, I'm Muhammad and this and that. He stays out of the way. He won't go in the temple. He'll stay out of the way so the pujaris won't bump into him and touch him. And he'll say, I'm lower than the lowest. But we see that no one is pushing to get him into the Jagannath temple. But we see that Krishna himself, as Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, is coming to him every day. Everyone else goes to the temple to see the Lord, but here the Lord comes to see his devotee. Like that. So we have to understand all these are happening at once. This is the important thing. Otherwise, if we don't see so broadly, we tend to think, okay, we have two persons here. This one's respectable. This one's less respectable. Therefore, I'll respect the more respectable one, and the one who's not as respectable, I won't respect him at all. You know? But it's just a matter of how much more is the respect and in which way it's offered. Am I getting anywhere? Are we making any sense here? In other words, you have to be able to accommodate all this. Otherwise, we get caught up in the rule and regulation, and then we just become, that's what the smartest are. Smartest don't see all these levels. They just see, here's the rule, here, you know, it says here, that this, you know, in this verse here, it says this, but they don't understand the depth of it. They don't actually understand what's behind it. What are all the levels? Because unless you understand the spiritual realm, factually, unless one has knowledge of the spiritual realm, spiritual activity, spiritual culture in relationship with Krishna, and one has understanding of the process of chanting of the holy name, only then actually can you understand the Vedic culture and culture in general. Not the other way around. So you can be the biggest pandit, but unless you actually understand the Vaishnav culture and the spiritual culture, you cannot actually understand the Vedic culture. That's why there's so much confusion. Because you have all these material things, and then on top of that, then there's the spiritual. You have to be able to work with all of them at once. Then you actually understand dharma. Because otherwise you see sometimes it's saying, yes, this person is respectable. You must respect this person. Like it says there, you know, if a shudra past 90 years old, everybody's got to respect him. Right? But it says, but if he comes in contact with the king, okay, then the king gets, he adjusts. But if it's not the king, you know, it's not, you know, some big brahmana, or it's not a, you know, a pregnant woman, or someone else like this, then everybody will move for him. It means the general populace will move out of the way for the 90-year-old man. But now here it's saying it's not just by gray hairs that one is respectable. Because here we have Kavi, who is a kid, and he is teaching his relatives, his older relatives, and he is calling them child. And they're getting all bent out of shape, because what do you mean? You know, we're old enough to be your father, and you're calling us child. So then they went and asked the demigods, what's going on? I thought he was supposed to be cultured, this boy. You know, he's supposed to be learned and knowledgeable, therefore we're learning from him. But he calls us the child. Like that. And the demigods say, no, he is correct. Because someone who does not have knowledge, he is like a child. Child means he has no knowledge. Maybe physically you're old, but you don't have the Vedic knowledge. So therefore, he's giving you that knowledge. So as the previous verse meant, someone who teaches one, trains one in the Vedic knowledge, he is the father. Father and mother. So he's correct in what he says. And then they point out that it's not just by age and gray hairs that one is respected. One is respected for that. But even that respectable person is respected by, respects this person. Just like Brahma and Shiva in the material universe, there's no one higher than Brahma and Shiva. But they respect Vishnu. So that's what's going on here. So you see this happening at all levels. It can get very confusing. So if one understands that, does that make some sense? Continue? Like that. Otherwise, these scriptures will sink. Means any materialist reads them, or someone who's not, doesn't know them very well, will say it's all contradictory. It says this, it says that, it never says any. It's not. It's always consistent, as was pointed out in the beginning. First thing it said is, don't read this unless you're going to accept it, because the law is the law. It's correct, 100% right, always. But now it's up to us how we understand it and how we apply it. So it's right. It's never inconsistent. But the different things are applied at different situations. Like you have the old man and you have a young kid, but if the kid doesn't know anything, he respects the old man. Now if this old man is learning from this kid the Vedic knowledge, then he respects him. Right? But now let's say you have someone who is of spiritual knowledge, and they are learning a material thing from somebody who's older. That person who's older means that the younger person is submissive and inquires, has the interest to learn, and in that way respects the teacher. But the teacher also has to respect that spiritual person that they're teaching, because they know that this is my service to the spiritual person. Is this understood? It means the student who is the spiritualist is practicing, submissive inquiry and interest in the subject. But the person, the older person, is practicing sevaya. Means all these three elements are there. So because the student is actually more advanced spiritually, then the less advanced person respects him for that, and he feels this is my service to this spiritual person. And the spiritual person, because it's the process of learning, he must be submissive, and he must inquire, and practice what he's taught. That way you learn. Does this make some sense? So like this, you have to be able to see where these different levels, when they especially when they intersect, how things may flip around. It looks backwards, but it's not in any way contradictory. You know, it's just like, it is not contradictory that the mother, out of affection for the child, gives the child bitter medicine. One may think, mother, if she loves the child, will always give nice things and deal nicely and everything gently. But then she may give him bitter medicine for his health, or chastise him to keep him from growing up badly. So it may look contradictory, but someone who knows the science of motherhood understands this is not contradictory at all, because the underlying principle is always that of affection, always that of well-wisher. So some situations you may be very pleasant, and other situations you may have to be very firm, depending upon the situation. So there's no contradiction. So the scriptures are the same. They're trying to get us back to Godhead, but they're teaching us how to move in the material world without offending anyone, and how to see the material world in relationship to the spiritual world, and how to deal, interface between those from the spiritual world and those who are practicing to get to the spiritual world, and those who are from the material world. And then hear of those in the material world, then what is the differences in age, this, that, so many things. You know? So like this. These rules apply up and down, but they also have their interaction. When one level deals with another, the higher level always is more respectable. But within each level, you have all these different aspects. Right? You have all these different aspects. Okay. Then it goes on to show that after telling all this, that one who has knowledge, he is actually of respect. Then, as an elephant made of wood, as an antelope made of leather, such as an unlearned brahmana, those three have nothing but the names of their kind, because they can't do anything. You know, a wooden elephant, you get no elephants work. A wooden elephant doesn't do any work. You know, an antelope, you just have the skin. It's just stuffed. You know, it doesn't do anything. It doesn't jump around or do anything. So a Brahmin who is unlearned, then is the same. Is basically useless, like that. Therefore, it said the bottom, the first level is that one should have knowledge, right? One should have knowledge. So it says here that. In other words, the Brahmin who doesn't know anything is useless. Because how he will bet you. He's known as a Brahmin because he knows something that he can help you with. He can help, guide, teach, do. But if he can't do any of that, then he's useless as a Brahmin. It says, created beings must be instructed in what concerns their welfare without giving them pain. And sweet and gentle speech must be used by a teacher who desires to abide by the sacred law. So this is an important point, is that you want to teach someone, then it has to be for their welfare, but without giving them pain. If it gives them pain, it's not good. Though, as we discussed before, sometimes, you know, some strong language may have to be used. One may have to be very realistic in pointing out something if all other avenues aren't working. Is speaking sweetly and nicely
and in a very concerned way giving knowledge, and the student is not taking it seriously, then sometimes we may have to be sharp or in some way just wake them up. But that is mentioned in the Gita can only be done for someone who is working, who is, a dependent, someone who is under your charge. Then that can be done. If they're not, then the only option is this, speaking nicely. Yeah, says he whose speech and thoughts are pure and ever perfectly ever perfectly guarded gains the whole reward which is conferred by the Vedanta. So Vedanta is the end of knowledge. So Vedanta actually is for the purpose of awarding bhakti. Like that. One can actually understand. This is for understanding the Lord. Vedanta is paravidya, transcendental knowledge. So here he's saying, he didn't say here, which is conferred by the Veda, or conferred by all, you know, proper activities or pious activities. He didn't give any reward here in the way of karma or jnana. Here the reward is in the realm of bhakti, because that's what Vedanta is for. Vedanta is actually meant for understanding the Supreme Lord. So those who are not on that platform will think, okay, on the platform of jnana, then yes, he'll get that, which is better than fruitive activities. Therefore, the karmi, the jnani, yogi, then they will speak nicely and be gentle. But for one who actually knows the Vedanta, the end is transcendental knowledge. And karma and jnana are not transcendental. So the processes are not. So here, this means, so that whose speech and thoughts are pure, and, you know, always dealing carefully, means the austerity of the tongue is used, is applied, then that person gets the reward which is conferred by the Veda, which is love of Godhead. But we see this is not just for anybody whose speech and thoughts are pure. This means whose actually speech and thought is pure. Right? Because otherwise we sometimes come across, well, somebody who just knows is not. No, but if you're going to get the goal of the Vedas, or the result of the Vedas, which is understanding the Lord, or at least coming to the Brahma-Buddha platform, then that means the speech and thoughts actually have to be pure. And pure means there can be no material contaminations of passion or ignorance. So then we can understand who this is talking about. Right? Here's another of these verses. You come up where they're talking about the devotee or about pure devotional service. They come out direct now and again. We discussed before is that they're always there in the Vedic literatures. But Vyasadeva didn't make them stand out. This is just another verse. Therefore, Narad Muni told him to make it obvious by writing the Srimad Bhagavatam. Then you just say, this is it as it is. This is the perfection in all the Vedic knowledge. The conclusions that all the conclusive slokas in all the shastras, you take and put all those points together in one place in the Bhagavatam. So then that's given there. Yeah, it says here, let him not, even though in pain, one is very disturbed oneself, speak words cutting others to the quick. In other words, just right to the core of their heart. You just say something, it's just going to cut them to shreds. It says, even if you're very disturbed, a cultured man should not speak like that. Even if he's been very hurt or like that, one should not say like that. In other words, exactly fully what one may feel or think should never be said like that. It says, let him not injure others in thought or deed. Let him not utter speeches which make others afraid of him, since that will prevent him from gaining heaven. So now here it's being brought down to the level of what I was mentioning before. The last one is not dealing like this. This one is saying, so the other one is speech and thoughts are pure and all that. So someone is going to work for that who is very serious about the study of the Veda or practicing or very strong in sadhana like that. So you have to be able to catch, you have to put a higher level to that. You know, it has to be devotion for the devotees, but at least the Brahma-Bhuta for the jnanis. But here we have to bring it down to the level that it applies to everyone, so that everyone will take it seriously. Because the last verse, the person who is materialistic, you know, who is interested in fruitive activities, may not take it seriously. Like that. Because he's the one who's going to be disturbed the most. The jnani is not disturbed by much. The devotee is not disturbed by much. The fruitive worker gets very disturbed. If he loses profit or pious activities or material opportunities, he gets disturbed very much. They identify with the body. Something happens to the body, they're disturbed very much. So then here it's saying, don't do anything. Don't make people afraid of you. Don't injure others in thought or deed. Don't speak very harshly to them. Otherwise, it'll prevent you from going to heaven. So the last one has already covered this point, but now to make it very clear, it is being brought out that those you want material gain. So the materialist, even he has to follow this. Otherwise, he won't get to heaven. You know? So he'll follow it because he won't get to heaven. The impersonalist will follow it because it'll get him to the Brahman platform. The devotee follows it because this is what pleases Krishna. Because Krishna, his devotees, and everything is Krishna's, expand from Krishna. Therefore, he deals with everything as Krishna's. So he deals very nicely in this way. Like that. So we also have to see this as on the material platform, it will always be very gently done. Like this. In the practice of devotional service, then we may sometimes be stronger or less. In other words, to protect what's right or establish what's right, sometimes one has to be a little strong. But it has to be that the other person has benefited by it. We see, Srila Prabhupada sometimes would be very strong. Thunderbolt and rose. Lord Chaitanya also, thunderbolt and rose. But it increased all those who he was dealing with. It increased their seriousness, increased their attraction to Krishna or affection. Like this. But if by dealing harshly it takes someone away, then that's not good. Then that will not please Krishna. You won't go back to Godhead. You know, you don't actually have knowledge because you're attached to result, so you're not going to get to the Brahman. And you're attached to result, but you're not uncultured. You're not even going to get heaven plans. So in other words, in all spheres, you're not going to progress. Therefore, one should behave nicely. As we see here, Kabi, he's saying, he called them little sons. But he says it nicely. He's saying it affectionately. The demigods didn't complain about his dealings. Right? So he was dealing properly. They took it wrong. But what he said should not be taken wrong. Just like Yudhishthir, then, who was it? Ajatashatru. For him, there's no enemy that's been born. That doesn't mean that people don't think he is their enemy. But for him, he has no enemy. Duryodhana wasn't his enemy. No one was his enemy. Like that. But Duryodhana thought Yudhishthir was his enemy. For Duryodhana, so many enemies have been born. For Kamsa, so many enemies were born. But for Yudhishthir, no enemy is born. He doesn't see anybody as enemy. So if we deal properly, someone else may take it wrongly. We try to avoid that. But we still cannot compromise, you know, truth or this or that. Or we'll just not speak or avoid the situation or in some way try to make it so it won't be too rough. But in speaking nicely and gently, here Kavi was dealing gently. But his elder relatives, who he was teaching, took it badly.
So he didn't offend them. They became offended by their lack of knowledge because they were little sons. Right?
Yeah. So, yeah. Just the thing on the one before what we were talking is that it says, neither through years nor through white hairs, which is age, through wealth, which is for Vaishyas, through powerful kinsmen, for Kshatriyas, that the Kshatriya, that the sages have made this law. So already we said that these are items to be respected. But it's saying here, in comparison to knowledge, all these others have no real meaning. So therefore, seniorities is from sacred knowledge. That of Kshatriyas from valor. That of Vaishyas from wealth and grain. That of Shudras from age. So all these are respectable. But compared to knowledge, then these aren't respectable. These have no standing. The person with knowledge is higher. Then within those not in knowledge, then one with power is more respectable than one with wealth, who's more respectable than one with age. Same time as within the realm of those who are powerful, then if they're all equally powerful, the one with more age is more respectable, or the one with more wealth is more respectable, or the one who has more of these qualities. Someone has all three, he's more respectable than someone who has two or one. And amongst the Vaishyas, those who have more influence or more age or more wealth. Of Shudras, then who has more age? Because age generally means experience. You're doing an art, so you get experience. So one has to see is that all these four then apply in all the levels, but at the same time, is each one of them must be seen how it, I think, say, the same time as the knowledge, the element of knowledge is higher than that of influence, which is higher than wealth, which is higher than age. But within, in the realm of knowledge, you can apply the other three. I mean, all four. Within the realm of the Kshatriyas, then also, like that. That is, does this make sense? That was the conclusion of the last thing. Okay, so then here, proper behavior. Then, goes on that in this, now we have such a person. Gentle, properly behaved, has knowledge, can teach that, so very respectable. And such a person gains all benefit. Now here is the attitude himself. Now it's talked about others, how they deal with them. Now this one is then for the person himself. A Brahman should always fear homage as if it were poison, and constantly desire to suffer scorn as he would long for nectar. For he who is scorned, nevertheless, may sleep with an easy mind, awake with an easy mind, and with an easy mind walk here among men, but the scorner utterly perishes. So the person who's been scorned, what does it matter? He sleeps nicely, it's nothing, you know, it's like, he's humble, he's not looking for praise. So if one is humble, one actually is pure in thought, and what is it here? Pure. Speech and thoughts are pure. Then someone else speaks badly of him, what does he care? For himself personally, he has no difficulty. Person who has speaking badly about the other person, they'll perish. They will lose out on the material and spiritual platforms. But he himself has nothing to worry about. If you have nothing, there's no problem. But Krishna says in the Gita that one who is, the peace formula is, you understand Krishna is the Lord of everything. He owns everything. And he is everyone's friend. And if I think I am everybody's friend, so if someone feels bad towards me, then I feel bad, you know. Or I'm not respected as the biggest, greatest, or the biggest controller, then there's a problem. So peace comes because there's no material desire. When there's no material desire, one is peaceful. If there's material desire, one is not peaceful. So therefore, one scorned is, they have to be humble.
And it helps one maintain the point of understand material world is not a place of misery. It's not worthwhile. Only Krishna, him and his activities, his devotees, all that is worthwhile. So if I absorb myself in thinking of Krishna, then I am happy. And no material needs, no one respects. You're peaceful because you don't want it anyway. It's seen, you see homage as if it were poison. Like that. Because also if somebody is chastising, then you're always sharp to develop. If no one's chastising, one has a tendency to become lax. So one wants to avoid that. It says, a twice born man who has been sanctified by the employment of the means described above, in due order, shall gradually and cumulatively perform the various austerities described for those who study the Veda. So one who has been sanctified by these means, by following the process that has been described in the Shastras, shall also continue to develop those. He will gradually develop and expand and on this. Because what's happening is you learn these things, but then you have to practice. And then at some point in your practice, you have to take that this is my values. My value is to follow, you know, this knowledge that's given by the scriptures. Follow this process of devotional culture, devotional activities, the goals of the Sankirtan mission and the chanting of the holy name, and take them as one's own. That must come. So one who has been purified by the process of going through it and learning it, then will take this as his own and then practice it. And gradually one will be able to follow each one deeper and deeper and get more and more understanding from it and more benefit. So one has to come to that point. This is called nididhyasana, where one actually values and applies what one has learned. Because you understand his purpose. That. An Aryan must study the whole Veda together with the Rahasyas, performing at the same time various kinds of austerities and the vows prescribed by the rules of the Vedas. In other words, you must study the Vedic knowledge together with the philosophy. It means you take a branch of the Vedic knowledge. If you don't discuss it, discuss it in relationship to the spiritual knowledge, then it actually is not beneficial. It becomes avidya. It changes from being aparavidya, which means one which helps bring one to the platform of transcendental consciousness, to being avidya. Means which takes one away from Krishna. Instead of helping take one towards Krishna, it'll take one away. So they must be studied together. Because anything in relationship to Krishna is sat. Anything that's not, is not. Though Krishna does say, if you can't study this knowledge in relationship to sat, you know, can't follow, in other words, for the purpose of devotional, okay, at least just follow it. But it's understood that that's dropping down into the material platform. So of the material platform, better one who, you know, follows the Vedic culture than one who doesn't. But higher than that is someone who follows in relationship to him. That's the best. So here, then, you must study the Veda with its actual meanings. What is its purpose? What's behind it? Why do it? You know, like we study these, like we study the whole devotional lifestyle, but we have to know what's behind it. Why? What's the philosophy? Then, why? Because then we can teach it to others. We have to have this knowledge, and we have to be able to convince ourselves. So you must know both. Even you're studying some material branch of knowledge, You must know it in relation to how it connects to Krishna. Like, let's say you're learning astrology. Unless you can see the astrology in relationship to Krishna, it won't take you to Krishna, it'll take you away. But if you study it in relationship to Krishna, in other words, with the rahasyas, the hidden meanings, it means Krishna is hidden. Right? So if you study it in relationship to Krishna, then it takes you to Krishna. And this is the secret. It's the same thing. That's why I said the Maya, it's like electricity. It can heat and it can cool. You can get either out of it. Material energy can take you to hell or help take you back to Godhead. She can help you get to the platform of Brahma-Bhuta, or she can take you in the exact opposite direction. Just depending upon whether you are seeing it in relationship to Krishna or not. That's all. So it's like that. So it must be seen like that. Any branch of knowledge has to be seen like that. If it's not, it will not give a beneficial result. You know? Like I've seen. Let us take, something topical. I've seen devotees study Kavi. Right? Management techniques and principles and all these things of Kavi. I've seen devotees take them, apply them very nice in their devotional life, very nicely situated in devotional service, and they advance nicely. I've seen other people who are become very expert in all these things that takes them right away from devotional service. Same like Sanskrit. So many devotees learn Sanskrit and they go away from Krishna consciousness because they're studying the Sanskrit not in relationship to Krishna. Not for the purpose of pleasing Krishna, just they themselves are interested. They go away. Well, if you study it with the rahasyas, means how does this Sanskrit connect to Krishna? How can I apply it simply for Krishna's satisfaction under the guidance of Guru and Sadhu? Right? Then we see it goes very nicely. And they advance. So the whole thing is it doesn't matter what it is, Vedic or non-Vedic, if you study it in connection to Krishna, you can advance. You don't study it in connection to Krishna, it'll take you away from Krishna. Because then the same thing turns. Right? The same thing just turns. It transforms from something that helps you back to Godhead is aparavidya, or it transforms into advidya, which takes you away. Even though it's knowledge, learning Sanskrit is great knowledge, vidya. But if it's not in connection with Krishna, it's considered by the sages avidya, because it takes you away from Krishna. You may become expert in the realm of karma and jnana, but what's the use of that? No use. So that if you see it in relationship to Krishna, then it becomes aparavidya, which means it's supportive of paravidya, transcendental knowledge. It becomes dovetailed. It's connected. It becomes empowered by the chit potency to help you go back to Godhead. So it becomes a platform of service. Then it helps. And then how does one gain this? Now, this is very important. The other half of the verse says, you must study the whole Veda. In other words, you don't just take a part of the Veda and think you know everything. Until you know the whole thing, you don't actually know the whole thing. You have to know all the elements, then you know. You take an item, you have to know all the different aspects about it. Otherwise, you don't really know the item. Because any branch of knowledge has many, many aspects to it. So in the Vedic knowledge, then it has so many different aspects of the culture, the rituals, the language, the histories, how these Dharma Shastras, how to just the culture, how to relate with other people. All these different aspects, one should know all these things. And then it's a complete picture with the purposes behind them. But then it says, at the same time, various kinds of austerities and vows prescribed by the rules of the Vedas must be performed. In other words, while you're studying, there must be service going on. The brahmacharya
But the brahmacharis must be followed, or the rules of a snataka, or, you know, someone who is studying the Veda. These things must be there. Someone who's practicing Krishna consciousness. Sadhana bhakti must be there. And devotional activities must be there. Otherwise, you cannot realize it. Pariprashna is not enough. There must be seva. There's no seva, the pariprashna does not give the fruit of realization. So as we saw in the last verse, is someone with realization will take what he's learned and apply it in his life and slowly and gradually expand all that. So now here it's then explaining how that's done. You have to take study the Vedic knowledge, and you must do it with the inside meanings. It means, in other words, how the Bhagavatam presents it. And you must also perform service. Otherwise, without that, it's not complete, and it won't get you anywhere. You actually will not. You may gain in material knowledge, but we've already seen that material knowledge has no real meaning compared to spiritual. So if we want to go back to Godhead, then we must be doing service at the same time. And seeing this knowledge with its hidden meanings means in connection with the Lord. Taking knowledge, seeing it in relationship to the Lord, and then performing service, that combination then gives one proper realization and advancement. Then all the things it's been talking about before come. Otherwise, they won't come. Can't come. Like that. Let a brahmana who desires to perform austerities constantly repeat the Veda, for the study of the Veda is declared to be, in this world, the highest austerity for a brahmana. So someone who wants to be austere, then the best austerity is study of the Veda. That is the best. You study the transcendental knowledge. In other words, study of Bhagavatam, of Gita, you know, Chaitanya Charitamrita, Nectar Devotion, this is the best of austerities. It's the highest austerity for a brahmana. Because a brahmana's business is to go back to Godhead, understand the Vedic knowledge, understand its relationship to Krishna, and this way surrender to Krishna. So that's the greatest austerity, is that aspect which gets one the topmost result, right? We generally think, well, that's not very austere. You know, standing on your head or, you know, holding your breath is much more austere, or, you know, eating one grain of rice a day. You know, something like this is much more austere. But why do people do those things? Because it gives some material result. Right? So you have to do very, very heavy, heavy austere, like Hiranyakashipu stands on his, in talasan. I don't know if you know talasan. It means you stand on your toes. It means not a ballet style. It means on the ball of the feet. And then you put both hands up in the air and spread the fingers apart. Because that's like a tall tree. And the fingers are spread out like that. You just put your arms right up in the air. So you do that on your toes. You know, do that for however, you know, long he did that. You know, you do that for 5 minutes, you'll notice that it's an austerity. So, but he wants a material result. Therefore, because your result you want is material, some benefit for the body, right? Therefore, the austerities also must happen with the body. Right? You understand? So it looks like it's a greater austerity, but actually it's less. Because, you know, it's just like you fast. Let's say you know that noontime there's a feast. So you fast in the morning. People think you're very austere. No, you're fasting because you know you can eat more at lunch. You understand? So the two, they balance each other. How much austerity, that much pleasure. A little austerity, little pleasure. So you want more pleasure, you do heavier austerity. But they balance. You never get more than that. You don't get more. So the pain that you went through in fasting,
is then balanced by how much happiness you get out of eating. So you may think, I get so much more eating, but you forgot about all the austerity. So here, if we want material knowledge, means knowledge, then one must study the Veda. Because then the austerity is of the intelligence, and you're getting the intelligence back. And then if we take that to the next platform, then we study the spiritual scriptures, the paravidya, the transcendental knowledge. Then that by that austerity, we will gain understanding of the spiritual realm and the spiritual process of Krishna, the process of chanting Hare Krishna. But it must be performed, we saw before, to get realization in relationship to service. So just studying Bhagavatam all day, if that's not, that is being just your service, then one has to do something to keep oneself engaged, purified, until one comes to the platform that he's pure enough that he's off the bodily platform. It means Brahma Bhuta, then you can just read. But otherwise, then one needs to practically apply oneself at some point. There must be some, how do you say, other activities that supplement. It means the process of sadhana must be there. So the aspect is the, until one is fully situated on the Bhagavat platform, one has to have support of these other aspects. Other the sadhana and the Vedic. Once one's on that Bhagavat platform, then one doesn't need. And once one comes to the platform of spontaneous devotional service, then these reading and all that, then naturally that becomes itself a very dynamic service. Very dynamic service that attracts one to Krishna very quickly. But because we ourselves are Gostiyanandis, that is Lord Chaitanya's desire, therefore the preaching, even when it's on that platform, one could read it, Bhagavatam all day, one still preaches Bhagavatam. Like that. So that is balanced very nicely there. Verily, that twice-born man performs the highest austerity up to the extremities of the nails, of his nails, who, through wearing a garland, daily recites the Veda in private to the utmost of his ability. So that it's the, yeah, if one, in other words, one absorbs oneself very nice in the scriptures. Prabhupada always is told the devotees, read, right? Read his books. He recommended 2 hours a day, right? But we don't find many devotees doing it. Then it'll be said, oh, have to do this, have to do that. But why is it that of the two, it's like consistently everyone will take, or most will take, the doing something else and not studying the books? Because studying the books is actually more austere. It actually is the topmost austerity. Therefore, it's very difficult to sit down and every day, day in, day out, read 2 hours. With full concentration. Because it's so austere. Because this austerity gives the highest benefit. Means if it's the highest austerity, it must be giving the highest benefit. You know, I mean, you have that demon who's cutting, you know, chunks of flesh off of his leg and offering them into the fire. You know, one could say, no, that's much more austere. But it's not, because it's just getting some material result. Right? The demon is willing to do that. Non-devotee, atheist, is willing to do that. But you ask him to sit down and read Bhagavatam every day, he won't do it. Can't do it. So the reason that it's difficult to sit down and study, because it's the topmost austerity. Like that. So this is the austerity for the Brahmin. It says, up to the tip of his nails. Means it's that austere. The whole, in other words, the whole body is fully engaged in this austerity. It means it's like the most intense. But it's pleasant. But because of its nature of being so subtle and so pure, therefore it's austere for the materialistic mind, which wants to be engaged in karma, jnana, yoga, and not in bhakti. Right? Like that. And most people are interested in karma. So even just studying from the angle of jnana, you'll find very few people who are interested. Just out of pure interest in knowledge. You know, setting aside devotion. So to study the books, this is the topmost. Twice born man who, not having studied the Veda, applies himself to other and worldly study, soon falls, even while living, to the condition of a Shudra and his descendants after him. So in other words, one studies the transcendental knowledge first, then if you have other areas of interest, then study that. That is the rule. It means because the Paravidya is the most important, you get that first. Transcendental knowledge is first. Then after that, then, you know, so many varieties of Vedic knowledge. Then after that, then you can get into other aspects of material knowledge. In other words, first is the core of the philosophy, the transcendental. Then you can get into Vedic or modern, you know, knowledge. But this is to be studied first. This is the most important thing. According to the injunction of the revealed text, the firstborn of an Aryan is from his natural mother. Oh, the first birth of an Aryan is from his natural mother. The second happens on the tying of the girdle of the Mungja grass. And the third on his initiation to the performance of a Shrauta sacrifice. So here is the different levels in the Vedic. It means the first birth is when one is born, you know, physically born from the natural mother. Second is then when he takes up study of the Vedic knowledge. But the third is when he's actually initiated into performing the sacrifices and all that. So in the Vedas it would be the Shrauta. Then in the our situation would mean the Pancharatra. Like that. So here is the three births. This is the Trija that Prabhupada talks about. So Prabhupada says whatever he talks about is from the Vedic literature. So here it is. We see that last one, he's talking about studying his books. Right? Like that, this is most important. And that's from here. And then he says that, you know, that one should perform service. He puts so much emphasis on, inquiring, studying, and serving. And that was here in the one before that. So you find that whatever, it's here. It means it's coming from the Vedic literature. But he is giving the Siddhanta, the conclusion. You know, it's very just directly said in relationship to devotional service. So the rahasya, he has made the rahasya, the hidden, unhidden, obvious. He has taken what was very difficult to find before and made it very easily available. So this is Prabhupada's glory. He has made what is very difficult to understand easily available. But still, the individual has to take it, as we discussed before, is that the individual must make the decision himself. That's the meaning of the value. That means you've decided yourself that you are going to do this because you feel it's important. Otherwise, it won't work. So here is the levels of the Trija he talks about. Among those three, the birth which is symbolized by the investiture with the girdle of the Munja grass is his birth for the sake of the Veda. They declare that in that birth, the Savitri verse is his mother and the teacher his father. Prabhupada also says this when he initiates. The Guru, he says, the Guru is the father and the Veda is his mother. So the Savitri is the Gayatri. And from the Gayatri expands the Purusha Shukta and the Vedas. So having the Gayatri means having the Vedas. So it mentions before that a Brahman who is initiated into the Gayatri and he chants the Gayatri, then it's benefit of the, how you say, of studying all the Vedas. In other words, showing the glory of chanting the Gayatri mantra. The Gayatri is so wonderful that by chanting it, one gets the benefit of reciting all the Vedas. Right? But then we see here is that then one may say, okay, I got Gayatri, I don't have to study. But then it goes on to say that a Brahman doesn't have the knowledge. That is also not very good, useless. You must study, and Prabhupada says, you must study these books. So in other words, you're pointing out the glories of one level, but then you're showing that above that there's also more, higher aspects, higher levels. Like that. So we see here is that the Savitri verse is this, so probably point out, is the mother and the teacher is father. So the Veda is the mother and the teacher is the father. So that combination, then one is born into spiritual knowledge. Right? Between the mother and father. And on the third birth, here he's talking about the second, but the third birth, then it's the same thing. Then we're talking about the transcendental knowledge. The transcendental knowledge. Then that becomes, and the transcendental teacher, then these are, give us, they are our mother and father. So we have these three levels. In other words, the material level, the Vedic level of knowledge, and then the spiritual level. They call the teacher the pupil's father because he gives the Veda. Yeah, it means the teacher father. For nobody can perform a sacred rite before the investiture with the girdle of Munja grass. In other words, until one has got the blessings of the guru, and in here until he's taken the sacred thread, then he cannot perform the sacred rites. So unless we have received the second initiation, one doesn't perform the big sacred rites. One doesn't do the temple worship. One, so many different things one can't do. Like that. So therefore, yeah. So the one who initiates into that is called the father. Because before that you can't do anything, right? Before birth, nothing's happening. When you're born, activities start. So when you're born into the Vedic or the Pancharatric realms, then you can perform those activities. So when one receives the initiation, then one is able to worship the deity. Like that. So then that's considered more serious. That's when Bhajana Kriya becomes very serious. Because then one has the Sanskrit you call adhikar, which is what do you call it? It's like right, it's qualification, but this still doesn't mean that it's one's has. Just like someone gets married, then at marriage, now they have the adhikar, they can have children. Before marriage, they can't do that. But it doesn't mean that on the moment that they're married, now they have children. No, still time is there. So many things are there that have to be arranged. Like that. So when one receives second initiation, one has the adhikar to perform the deity worship. It doesn't mean one necessarily knows how to do it. One has to qualify himself. Like that. You know, so when it says you have the right, means you have the right to become qualified now and perform it. Doesn't mean that you have the right means that even if you're not qualified, then you can claim yes. I am a Brahman, I can do all these things, even though one does not know.
Says he who has not been initiated should not pronounce any Vedic text, excepting those required for the performance of funeral rites, since he is on a level with a Shudra before his birth from the Veda. In other words, except for funeral rites, because that is going to be done by whoever is the relative. There's certain mantras that are chanted. So depending upon, you know, the situation, the son or some other relative performs those rites, so they have to be done, and the person who's there has to do them. So whatever the mantra is, that anybody chants. But otherwise to worship the deities and that, and to chant the Gayatri mantras, that then one has to have initiation into that before they can do that. Like that. Otherwise there'll be no benefit. They will not function. The student who has been initiated must be instructed in the performance of the vows and gradually learn the Veda, observing the prescribed rules. So now he's been initiated and he must be instructed in how to perform the vows, learn the Veda, and then observe those things. So here's the point. He's qualified. He's been accepted to study. But now one must study. One must be taught how to follow. And one must understand how to follow, why one should follow, and one should do it. Like we mentioned before, one who knows the Veda, one who knows how to apply the Veda, one who actually applies it, and then one who realizes. So here he's saying the student should go through all these. He should learn it, he should know how to apply it, and he should apply it. Then if we do that along with service, as was mentioned in the previous verse, then there'll be realization. Then the fourth one will come. So you take the first three, when you add service, the fourth comes. Like that. Whatever dress of skin, sacred thread, girdle, staff, and lower garment are prescribed for a student at the initiation, the like must again be used at the performance of the vows. In other words, all these different elements that one is given for performance of the duties, these must be used throughout. It's not that he has his prescription. It's just like the brahmachari. He wears a dhoti, may wear saffron cloth or white cloth. But now, that's at the ceremony. But now, when he actually practically applies himself in his devotional duties, he also wears the same thing. It's not that he changes. In other words, what he's given and what he's taught, that's what he must practice. You're not given one thing and then practice another. Right? Like that. One has to follow what he's given. That's duty. That's vows. That one has a specific realm in which one can function. And one functions within that. Otherwise, if not, then what's the meaning? Student has certain facilities. He uses that facilities in his service. Grihastha has other facilities. He uses those in his service. Sannyasa, other facilities. They use that in his service. So their particular dress, their particular, you know, facilities, all that, that's what he uses in his service. When he practices his Krishna consciousness, he must use those things, the same things, not something else. Okay, so if there's any questions, we'll stop here, because now we go straight into what the student does. The brahmachari himself, exactly what are the duties, direct duties of a brahmachari. Yes.
Earlier on you talked about the about power and influence between Kshatriya and Vaishya. What's the difference?
No, power and influence are the same. Wealth is something else. Okay. See, power is what you can... See, power may be like you have so much, you know, fighting ability yourself, you know, so much of an army, like that. But the same way, another way to look at that is influence. Because sometimes the king, without using any of that, can influence by his ability of speech. He knows the Shastra by his... by his application of the niti or politics, he can influence. Like many wars have been won without any real physical strength. One great king, and the Rajasthani king, they were from the Rajasthani, maybe it was south, I think it was maybe Andhra. They were fighting, and there was another king that he came up against that he had to fight, that he had himself a very impenetrable fort, very difficult fort to challenge. Not only that, is that all the tribal kings in the area, you know, from the locale, then they were all supporting him with their armies. So, I mean, you got one king basically against another king with 16 vassals, or, you know, subservient kings and their armies. So it's not an easy thing. So as far as power goes, the one king is at a disadvantage. The other king has more power. But then he had spies in that inside the other king's, you know, city, in his palace. Not in the palace, but in the fort. You know, the fort. So then they, by messengers, got word to him that he was supposed to arrange 16 large boxes of jewels. They may have even sent them in for him. But whatever, it was arranged. And he was to have men, just some common-looking men, who were to take those boxes, you know, in a very, at night, you know, seemingly secretly, that would go near the palace and kind of off in the bushes so that the guards would catch them. So then the guards catch these men with the 16 boxes of jewels. And then they ask, they open the boxes, you know, what's this? And they find so much wealth. Now, what's happening with this wealth? You know, I mean, if it was full of bananas, then they'd probably just say, what's going on? You guys are crazy or something. But since it was full of diamonds, then they naturally ask, what's going on here? So then they won't speak. So then they start to, you know, encourage them to speak, you know, with some, you know, few well-placed applications of their sticks. So now these men, of course, are to put up some resistance, so it looks like there's something really going on, something real secret is happening. But after getting, you know, very mild beating, you know, because they just carry these things, it's not expected them to be real tough, then they naturally reveal the secret of what's going on. So then they say that what it is that the king that's outside the fort, means the one king that's on his own, he is sending these 16 boxes of jewels to the 16 tribal kings, thanking them for their support to his campaign. In other words, you understand? So then immediately, then the guards go to the king and tell the king, hey, you know, the king, the one that we're fighting outside, he just sent these boxes of jewels to the tribal kings, thanking them for their support. So then the king thinks, well, they must have some plan. You know, these 16 kings, and they may gang up on me and try to kill me. So then during the night, before the sun came up, then he escaped the fort, thinking that these tribal kings were going to try to kill him because they were actually on the side of the opposing king. And then news went to the tribal kings that, you know, that what had happened is that these guys have just been caught with all these jewels that were coming to them, that were being sent by the opposing king, you know, thanking for the, you know, their loyalty to his cause. So then they're immediately thinking that, well, this is not true, but how will we convince the king of that? If the king finds out about that, you know, since he's already been told, surely in the morning he's going to call for us and have us all either arrested or killed, you know, as traitors. So then they thought, well, let us escape with all of our men tonight before the sun comes up. So then in the morning, the opposing king just easily walked in, you know, without a fight into the fort. Just in the morning, they just went up, you know, and demanded to open the gates, but the king's gone, the other guys are gone, there's no one there to fight. So he just walked in and established himself as the king. So that's called influence. So even though the other one had more power or valor, this one had more influence, more intelligence. So influence is what you can do. Like Shakuni, we have to respect Shakuni because of his influence. He didn't have much power. His power was his influence. In other words, you can have physical power, you know, the army, or you can have influential power. Shakuni was very powerful. It's because of him that the whole Mahabharata scene was going on. Duryodhana is a small timer. And he unqualified, you know, unqualified person. He did not have the determination and the vision, you know, to actually establish himself as the emperor of the world. He just has to see Bhima and he's completely upset. You know? Like that. And everything he tries to do to Bhima is frustrated. So naturally he's just going to forget all this. But Shakuni says, no, no, you have to continue. You know? Even Krishna came as a messenger to just say, okay, this is a last chance. We got to go for peace and all that. And they made some special arrangement to put Krishna on a seat, special seat. When he sat on the seat, then they pulled a lever, and then that seat just disappeared into the earth. It was on a shaft, very deep shaft. And then they just closed the top, and, you know, so much for Krishna. Because their thing is that the Pandavas are strong because of Krishna. You get rid of Krishna, the Pandavas are finished. So then, after they're all sitting there and enjoying their victory, they've gotten rid of Krishna, so now they'll easily defeat the Pandavas. Then the whole court, you know, the court that's there, you know, it's a big hall with its pillars, everything starts shaking, you know, like it's an earthquake. And then slowly, and the floor starts breaking. Right? And then marble breaks and things start breaking. This monstrous peacock feather starts poking up through the floor. You know, like this. And slowly then Krishna comes out in a partial manifestation of the universal form. You know, takes up the whole sky. So now you can imagine what that does to Duryodhana. You know, he's just thought, I've just gotten rid of Krishna and everything, and now the Pandavas are finished. Then he sees that, you know, Krishna's God, you know, so there's no getting rid of him. So he's just like that, okay, forget it, you know, just go to the forest and, you know, why bother? But Shakuni tells, no, this is nothing. It's just some mystic power. Krishna's got a little mystic power. He made a little show for you. Don't worry about it. You just go on. You're doing the right thing, you know? So then he got fired up. Otherwise, many times Duryodhana would have gave up. Completely. So Shakuni has so much influence, he's able to influence him to maintain. So therefore he's very powerful. That's power. You know? So he's a big player in the Mahabharata story. Right? All throughout, as it's all happening. He's very influential. So influence is also seen as power. And therefore amongst kings, both these, the power, valor, influence, it's all used. Because it's all different aspects of the same thing. You know? Different aspects of the same thing. Okay? Anything else?
Another question. when you're talking about connecting different bodies of knowledge to Krishna, could you explain the difference between connecting Vedic knowledge to Krishna? You said about if it's not connected, then it leads you away from Krishna.
Mm.
And the result of connecting non-Vedic knowledge to Krishna, a Western type.
Means both, Yukta Vairagya means both Vedic and modern can be used. Like
be
that.
Any difference in result? Or is it
depends what you're using it for. I mean, you know, it may be more easy to look in the car manual on how to run the car than to look in the Bhiman Shastra in the Atharva Veda. You know, Bhimans tell you how to, you know, fly around the universe in, you know, swan airplanes. So it may not work so well for trying to run a Mercedes or something. It may be easier to look in the Mercedes manual. But you're using the car and your knowledge of the car, how to run the car for Krishna's service. Like that. So it depends on the situation. But as far as culture goes, that we take from the Vedas. The Vedic literatures. Mm-hmm. The Bhagavatam, the Gita, Nectar Devotion, Chaitanya Charitamrita. That's where we take our culture from, our own private culture. And then using things in interfacing with the material nature, then that can be taken from any place. Though the principles are always based on the rihasas, or the actual Krishna conscious content, Krishna conscious application. Like that. Does that make any sense?
Yes, I think is there at any stage some pitfall in using that? Like say you say the car, and then recently there's been talks about disruption caused by computers and things like that, using the technology which isn't...
If you use it in Krishna's service and follow, you know, the proper etiquettes and all these things like that, then generally there won't be disturbance. As long as something has some application, it's used. When there's no more need of the application, then it's not used. So the one has to not become attached to it. Okay. That's the main. We don't take the culture of that material thing. We always stick to our own culture. Right? You know, there's a culture of people who drive around cars. You know, depending on what kind of car, then there's different kinds of... But we don't take those. We take our own culture. So in that way, we drive around and we do our service. So maintaining our culture means being humble and seeing things in relationship to Krishna. Then we advance in Krishna consciousness. Like that. We don't take the, you know... Yeah. We don't pack into the car with 15 of our other friends with their feet and arms and heads sticking out the windows and screeching down the street on both sides of the street and driving over the sidewalk and yelling and screaming and, you know, throwing 7-Up bottles out the windows. And, you know, like, means, you know, some people have cars, they like to do that kind of stuff, you know, but we won't do that. We won't, you know, use our car like, you know, a proper devotee gentleman, you know. Okay, we'll end here. Om Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare.